As Israel and Hamas continue to battle an ongoing war in the Middle East, communities throughout the nation, including here in Wisconsin, are seeing a marked increase in hate crimes and rising anti-Semitism. First Amendment advocates say they're worried that both pro-Palestinian and pro-Israeli speech is being suppressed on college campuses, and protests on both sides of the conflict have erupted worldwide. But the roots of the conflict stretch back decades, with complicated issues at stake and no easy answers. Welcome to Route 51. I'm Shireen Seewert. Today, we learn about the history of the conflict in Israel, the climate of free speech on campuses and in Wisconsin communities, and what to expect as the war rages on. In a few minutes, we'll talk with Dr. Edgar Francis, who is an associate professor in history, graduate program coordinator at the University of Wisconsin Stevens Point. But now we'll talk with Dr. Demir Kovacevic, an assistant professor of political science at the University of Wisconsin Eau Claire, who has extensive knowledge of issues in the Middle East. Professor, welcome back to Route 51. It's great to see you again.
Thank you for having me. My pleasure.
Tell me a little bit about your background and how much interest you've had in Middle East relations over the years.
Sure. So my training is in political science, particularly international relations. So I have a PhD and focused on that. So I teach classes on introduction to world politics, international relations theory, political violence, international conflict. So although I've never taught a specific like area studies course on the Arab-Israeli conflict or Middle East studies, it's a conflict that time and time again comes up in my classes. It did before 2023 and October 7th. It certainly does now. It's often a case study that we dig into in my intro classes as well as my upper level classes. So it's always been one of those situations that we've been studying with different generations of students going back to 2014 when I started teaching.
And I'm curious, with as long as you've studied the war and the conflict that's going on over there, were you surprised in October when everything just erupted? Was that something that took you, was it shocking to you? Or is it something that you kind of expected all along to happen?
I think it's not surprising in the grand scheme of things because we've seen conflict with these sides before. The event itself was shocking in its magnitude and what it created. If Western powers and Israel was caught off guard, then certainly someone like myself, who is not glued into the intel channels, was caught off guard. So I think the magnitude of an event in that Saturday morning, I think that's what was shocking. The fact that Hamas and Israel are fighting isn't so surprising, considering we've seen this in most recent history, 2021, 2014, 2012, 2008. So it's strange to say that it's expected almost that they'll continue fighting. It's more difficult to sort of look at what happened October 7th and say, I expected it to go that way, right? I don't think we expected it to be in that light, but to sort of say that they're fighting, that's not so much a surprise. The attack itself was the shocking thing and how it was executed.
What does Hamas want? What are they hoping to accomplish, and why did they attack now?
Going back to their formation, their kind of official formation in 1987, they're an offshoot of something called the Muslim Brotherhood, which originated in Egypt back in the 20s. And so they're an offshoot of that kind of organization that historically operated in Egypt. And in 1987, their call was for essentially the destruction and the elimination of Israel. And so they have kind of a message that is rooted in kind of an Islamist ideology of a Palestinian Islamic state, right? There is an Islamic resistance movement. And unlike the Palestinian Authority, which operates and governs the West Bank region of Palestine, and is more likely to and has in the past had peace negotiations with Israel, has considered the existence of Israel, has considered a two-state solution possibility. Hamas's goal is strictly on this one-state idea, that one state being for Palestinian people. And so what they want is to ultimately delegitimize and eliminate Israeli, what they see as illegal occupation. And so they view themselves as a national liberation movement. And a lot of Palestinian folks in the region see it that way. The issue with them, and they have political support, is that when they become militant, often their military tactics bleed into terrorist tactics. And that's where you get the outrage from Western countries and the rest of the world, where we recognize that you have political support in Palestine, and that you have won political elections before, and that you represent people in Gaza, but your tactics often fall into an arena of legality in terms of international humanitarian law.
The roots of this conflict are not new. They go way back. I mean, way back before my time. I mean, when did this really all start?
Yeah, and with Edgar as the historian, I know he'll probably fill in more of this timeline. I'll say a good 20th century beginning point would be going back to the time of the end, the kind of the end of World War I. Britain at that time was given a mandate over the region to oversee this region along with some other regions, which is modern day like Iraq today, and France oversaw modern day Syria. And the Balfour Declaration of 1917 essentially established that a Jewish homeland would be created here for Jewish people fleeing Nazism, leading up to, of course, World War II and throughout World War II. So we saw more and more Jewish folks from Europe moving into the region. The issue was that there was a sizable Arab population already living there. Flash forward to 1947, 1948, you have the UN Partition Plan, which ultimately establishes an Israeli state and a Jewish state and an Arab state. It was accepted by the Jewish people. It was rejected by the Arab civilians living there, which then leads to the kind of the first modern 20th century war between the two sides, leads into what we call the Al-Nakba, the catastrophe, that this mass exodus of Palestinian refugees that many of them have still not returned as of today, that ultimately then establishes the new Israeli state, or what we know today as the Israeli state. Israel declares itself a state. It's recognized quickly by other Western powers and the United States. And everything since 1948 on has been this kind of conflict over and possibility of, can we see a Palestinian state coexisting with an existing Israeli state with borders that have been implemented in 1948, but that have somewhat changed in 1967, 1973, and on? And what would those borders look like between the two sides?
You, as a historian and somebody who has studied so much about wars, are you concerned that this will turn into a much wider war that goes well beyond the borders that they are that the fighting is in now?
Well, in a way it has, and that is often a concern. If you think about the support that Hamas has in the region, it's rather complicated, but and they're funded and backed and trained by Iran, which is a hostile nation state to Israel. They are often in coordination and backed by Hezbollah, which is another resistance and terrorist organization in southern Lebanon, which has been fighting Israel there. It's been backed by the Houthis, which is again a militia group in Yemen. It's part of what Iran calls this kind of axis of resistance in the region, where you have Iran, Hamas, Hezbollah, the Houthis, different paramilitary groups in Syria and Iraq, who are opposed to, of course, Western rule and Israel. We've also heard of, funding from Turkey. Some of their leaders are actually living in Qatar, and are funded by Qatar. There is a complicated relationship with Egypt, where Egypt would like to not see so many Palestinian refugees moving into Egypt, because then that would ultimately mean the existence of a Palestinian state is in peril. But they also would like to see the influence of Hamas kind of tamed, because they've dealt with their own sort of Islamist and terrorist organizations in the past with the Muslim Brotherhood. And so the conflict is widespread, and in a way it's brought sort of these in Islam, we call them the Sunni and the Shia sects. It's brought different Sunni and Shia groups together, and they found common ground when often they're sort of split, and they found and the common ground in this case has been the destruction of Israel.
You're listening to Route 51. That's Dr. Damir Kovacevic, who stays with us. We'll bring on Dr. Edgar Francis now as well. Dr. Francis is an associate professor and history graduate program coordinator at the University of Wisconsin-Stevens Point. Dr. Francis, thank you so much for being here. I'd like to ask you a little bit about Zionism. What is it? What does it have to do with this conflict?
So Zionism is the ideology that the Jews of the world are not just people who share a religion, but that they are a distinct people, a nation, and that this nation needs to have its own nation, nation state. Just like, there's Germany, there's Italy, there's France, and so forth. This is an ideology that came out of late 19th century Europe, where the really the thinkers who were the first to lead Zionist organizations and start to advocate for Zionism, they argued that even that Jews had been living as minority communities throughout the world since the first century CE, what we call the diaspora. And by the late 19th century, these leaders said, look, Jews are unable to live as minority communities in Europe. They aren't able to live a full life, despite the promises of the Enlightenment and political reforms in Europe in the 19th century and so forth. So these leaders said Jews are not being allowed to live as Germans, as Russians, or as Frenchmen or whatever. The Jews of the world should have a nation state of their own. And the logical place for such a state in their mind was geographically, what we call Palestine. At that time, it was part of the Ottoman Empire. That's the region that had been home for the ancient Kingdom of Israel. And a slogan that is often attached to Zionism is a people without a land for a land without a people. That is to say, bringing the Jewish people back to the land of that ancient kingdom. However, in the late 19th century, Palestine was home to people. There were ethnic Arabs who lived there. And so the origins of this conflict go back to going back before Israeli independence. It goes back to this conflict between Jewish settlers who wanted to establish a state for Jews on this land, and the Arab people who were living there at that time.
Yes, we'll take a break and we'll get right back into all of this fascinating discussion. You're listening to Dr. Edgar Francis and Dr. Damir Kovacevic on Route 51. We're discussing the history behind the Israel-Hamas dispute, anti-Semitism in Wisconsin communities and campuses as well. We'll talk about that in just a little bit. I'm Shireen Sewart. This is Route 51 on Wisconsin Public Radio. We're back on Route 51 on Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Shireen Sewart. Dr. Edgar Francis and Dr. Damir Kovacevic are our guests today. A discussion on the conflict in Israel and the ripple effect reaching Wisconsin communities. I'm curious about what effect World War II had on all of this, and also how the people who were living in the Palestinian areas reacted when their communities were targeted for an Israeli state. Damir, what do you know about that?
I'll go back a little bit to sort of the end of World War I, kind of the end of the Ottoman Empire to taking us up to World War II. Following kind of the end of the Ottoman Empire, the British had a mandate over the region that is, today Israel, and at the time Palestine, and a few other areas in the region as well, as along with other European powers. And back in 1917, there was the Balfour Declaration that essentially stated that there would be a Jewish homeland for Europeans fleeing Nazism in Europe at the time. And throughout the 20s and 30s and 40s, we saw more and more migration into what is today Israel, what at the time was Palestine. In 1947, so if we fast forward a little bit, there was a UN partition plan that was proposed, which would have essentially split the land into a Jewish homeland and an Arab homeland. It was accepted by the Jewish people. It was rejected by the Arab people. To them, they were a majority of the population, and they were now getting a minority of the land in a significant chunk from what it was, a day prior, those years prior to that, which then led to the sort of first Arab-Israeli War of 1948, 1949, leading to kind of a mass exodus, displacement of Palestinian refugees. It's often called the Nakba, the catastrophe. Ultimately, then the state of Israel declares independence, and the borders that we understand to be Israel today look somewhat like that in 1948, although there's been additional kind of land added to that. And then moving forward, after that time period, the state of Israel comes into existence. Many Palestinians then become refugees living in, well, today in Gaza and West Bank, but also in Syria and Lebanon and Jordan. And from then on, it's recognized by many world powers. I think the United States actually recognizes it the day of or the next day. And then you have the currently what is the state of Israel.
Okay. I guess, you said something else earlier in the program that Hamas just wants to destroy the Jewish people. Why?
Well, from their perspective, this would go back, and I'll let the historian chime in on this more. But you take the a decades long conflict. They can point to major points in Israel Palestinian timeline: 1948 war, 1967 war, 1973 war. They can point to, the uprisings, the intifada, the of 1987, the early 2000s, sort of where they get their place in Palestinian history. They're an extremist actor, and they're a unique actor. And I think maybe we'll touch on this later, but I'll just briefly mention it here. They have political power in Gaza, but they're mostly known as a militant group, which is why they're often designated as a terrorist organization by most Western powers, the United States included, because of the things that they do, because of the tactics that they rely on. And some people may remember this who are a little older, but in the height of their suicide bombing campaign in the early 2000s and kind of the 2005 period, this was a main tactic of Hamas, right? Equated with the group. And so most people that understand Hamas understand it with that tactic, right? Using those kind of indiscriminate violent strategies that most people would classify as terrorism. And so it's this idea that there needs to be an Islamic land in what is today Israel, and that land needs to be Palestine for the Palestinian people without any kind of compromise, with any kind of negotiation, not recognizing any kind of Israeli state. So ultimately, what it would be a one state solution, but that one state would be a state run by Hamas for the Palestinian people that doesn't include the Jewish people.
So I think Damir really summed it up very, very well, that Hamas is both a nationalist organization and what we call an Islamist organization. That is to say, they want their state to be governed by Islamic principles, but it's if you will, the nationalist part is even more, is more important for your question, in that the Hamas leaders essentially believe that Jewish settlement in Palestine is completely illegitimate, that this should be land just for Palestinian Arabs. So it's and this so it's a fine line, but this is not specifically this is aggression and animosity directed against the state of Israel, and of course the the Jewish people of Israel and Jewish supporters of Israel, and not so much and within and yes, virulent anti-Semitism gets mixed up in that, but it's primary, but their goals are primarily national in the in that regard. The goal of a single state for for Palestinian Arabs, for Palestinians.
Since October, there have been a serious uptick in the number of hate incidents that have been recorded across the United States. For one example, there was a man in Wausau who is now running for mayor of the city who stood up at a Marathon County board meeting and kind of went on an anti-Semitic rant and blamed Jewish people for COVID and all sorts of things. That's just one example of many, and probably a mild one compared to some of the things that we're seeing nationwide. Why do you think this is happening? Why do you think that this action by Hamas triggered this kind of response from people in Wisconsin communities so far away from the conflict?
So you're asking a Middle East specialist to speculate what's going on, about what's going on in central Wisconsin. So
Yes.
keep in mind, I'm really stretching myself. What I see, and really I'm speaking more as an informed community member than anything else on this topic. I think what I see is this is a conflict with horrendous death, destruction, and pain being that was inflicted against Israelis and is continuing to be inflicted against Palestinians, to say nothing of what was going on before October 7th. And I think what I see is a number of people believing that they have to choose absolute sides, that to recognize the pain and suffering of Israelis means to completely de delegitimize the pain, suffering, and humanity of Arabs and Muslims, or on the other hand, to recognize the suffering of Palestinians is to completely delegitimize the humanity and suffering of Israelis and Jews the world over. And of course, I'm setting up some extreme polls here, but both in my view, both of those polls are illegitimate. The question of what should happen in relations between Israel and the Palestinian people is a political question that we can all disagree on, we can all debate. But no matter which side of the debate you're on, that doesn't mean that you are automatically denying the humanity of those who oppose you. Virulent anti-Semitism is, did not just crop up in the US on October 7th. Since 2015, the United States has seen increasing anti-Semitism in the way that anti-Semitic conspiracy theories have gotten airtime in a way that they never did, that we've been hearing more about them. Of course, there have been things like the synagogue shooting in Philadelphia a few years back. Certainly the October 7th attack, as I say, brings issues relating to Israel into sharp relief, and brings, and I think it's brought emotions to a boil.
Why 2015?
Um,
I mean, you were very specific.
yeah,
You
yeah,
said
yeah.
that.
Okay. Well, that is so. When I've looked at the data, that's really when people talk about things ticking up. And in my in my personal view, that's around the time, that is the time that Donald Trump began campaigning, on an on a very nativist political platform. And I want to make it clear, I am not accusing him specifically of it,
Sure.
of anti-Semitism. But it seems like since Donald Trump came in, came into American political life in such a such a major way, a lot of these fringe theories have gotten a lot more oxygen, if you will, in the room.
Tamir, briefly, what do you think? I mean, why do you think that anti-Semitism is on the rise on campuses, on and in communities throughout the US. I mean, when we're so far away from the conflict over there.
Yeah, I liked Edgar's point about these absolutes, and I think people who are seeing this, we're full of emotion, and we need to sort of we feel like we need to operate in these absolutes. Like, you need to tell me right now who's wrong and who's right in this. What side do I take? How do I interpret this? And often it's not that easy. And anti-Semitism, Islamophobia, these are not new concepts, right? These things, we see upticks in them, but we see these things surface usually in response to major events, where people, some people at least, ex respond in extreme ways. And bringing this topic up in class, literally the next day we were ca covering our terrorism unit, right? The day after this happened, or 2 days after it happened, that Monday. And coming into it thinking, okay, well, now this unit is going to have a lot more weight to it, of course. And coming in with the explanation of my students, which was, you are rifle and criticizing these kinds of attacks. You are rifle and criticizing the actions of Hamas. That doesn't mean that you are an anti-Palestinian, I mean, it doesn't mean that this is an attack on Palestinians. And at the same time, as we've seen the conflict progress, and we've seen some accusations of Israeli overaggression and sort of the killing of innocent civilians, you are rightful in criticizing the Israeli military response, the Israeli government response, and that doesn't necessarily make you an anti-Semite. And so those two things can very much be separated, where we can criticize existing governments, we can criticize existing non-state actors and terrorists, and we should. Just like we can criticize our own government, it doesn't make you anti-American or anti-Christian or anything like that. But I think people often respond to extreme events with these absolutes, rather than sort of thinking it through and, really thinking about what's going on. And it's complicated, I get that, but it doesn't mean that we have to operate in these absolutes.
We'll get back to the history of all of this in just a moment. I just want to ask one more question about this in light of these congressional hearings that we've had on these, the anti-Semitism in college campuses, especially at some of these Ivy League schools. Where's that coming from? And I mean, do you think that that's warranted? What's the issue there? Edgar, what do you think?
So with regard to those specific congressional hearings, the unfortunate thing, well, okay, yeah, unfortunately, what most people heard was the soundbite of college presidents being asked that question about genocide and university presidents waffling on the subject of academic freedom. What most people who didn't watch the full hearings didn't see was members of the committee leading with questions, basically about some of the slogans that Dumir had actually mentioned earlier, where, to use an example, the phrase from the river to the sea, it's something that's a phrase that's been used in some pro-Palestine rallies. Most of the people in those rallies who are think of it, if they say, from the river to the sea, Palestine will be free, they are thinking that Palestinians between the Jordan and the Mediterranean will have full legal and civil rights, which they do not under Israeli occupation. What many Jews hear is, when they hear that phrase, is they hear that land is going to be swept clean of Jews. So what I'm saying is, in those congressional hearings, Michelle Goldberg from the New York Times has suggested that these university presidents were led into a trap, and it's a trap that gets to one of the issues that Jamir brought up earlier, namely that some people conflate opposition to Israel with anti-Semitism. Now, with so I hope I've answered,
Yes.
I've answered part of what you were asking about.
Yes, absolutely. We do need to take a break and then we'll get back into more of the nuts and bolts about what's happening over in the Middle East and what has led to all of this conflict. You're listening to Dr. Edgar Francis and Dr. Dmir Kovacevic. They're our guests today on Wisconsin Public Radio discussing anti-Semitism, the roots of the ongoing conflict in Israel. I'm Shireen Seward. This is Route 51 on Wisconsin Public Radio. We're back on Route 51. I'm Shireen Seward. Dr. Edgar Francis and Dr. Dmir Kovacevic are with us talking about the many facets of the conflict in Israel, anti-Semitism in local communities, and how colleges are responding to that as well. Now, circling back to the situation in Israel, you talked about Hamas and its relationship to Palestinians, but do you have a sense, Dmir, of how many Palestinians actually support Hamas and really embrace its philosophies?
Yeah, it's a little tricky to answer. Sort of where the public opinion lies. What I have seen in recent years, what we've some have indicated even more recently, is that it's kind of split, and it might be weird to kind of admit that, but it is. But a lot of there is plenty of Palestinians today who have sort of lost hope and lost hope in kind of the Palestinian Authority, which operates in the West Bank, right? The Fatah party, the kind of the more legitimate moderate wing of the Palestinian side that at least will negotiate with Israel, have these talks with Israel, recognize Israel's right to exist. There's been a lot of support that's been lost, which explains how Hamas rose to power and back in 2006, ultimately winning legislative elections, which I think was a surprise to some people, and which is was denounced by Western powers, but. Today, I think there isn't sort of this overwhelming support for the Palestinian Authority, but there's others that have sort of admitted that what Hamas is doing is standing in the way of Palestinian statehood and Palestinian security, and so they're split. I mean, there's still an indication that if you know Palestine were to have another election, and they haven't since 2006, or presidential election, that people might actually support the kind of the Hamas-backed candidate. And the reason for that is, again, Hamas's story is somewhat complicated because we understand Hamas as the militant group, right? This Islamist group, and that's what they are largely. But historically, they've done a lot in terms of social services, with education, with clinics, with hospitals, with religious services. They're a political organization, so they have this kind of dynamic place in Palestinian society. And so the question of if not Hamas, then what? A lot of Palestinians don't really know what that other is.
Edgar, I mean, what about the role of other countries, nearby countries? Do they support Hamas when we're talking about, say, Egypt and, the surrounding areas?
Well, it gets very complicated. One of the main, one of the main outside supporters of Hamas is, is Iran. But also, money has been flowing to, to Hamas through, through Qatar. What's really interesting is the way that that Israeli governments over the years, and particularly the Netanyahu government, has effectively tolerated Hamas and to ensure that it's in place. Essentially, this this is still debated, but there's good reporting that Israeli officials effectively allowed funds to flow to Hamas, partly to keep the Gaza Strip quieter, partly because Israeli leaders didn't believe that Hamas could pull off any kind of a major attack like they did on October 7th, and partly as a deliberate strategy to maintain Hamas as a counterweight against the Palestinian Authority, to effectively prevent any any kind of a unified Palestinian political front that would create greater pressure on Israel to to work towards some kind of a two-state solution or negotiated agreement.
What efforts have been made to resolve these issues and actually move forward so that we're not in this kind of situation for years or decades to come?
So the mo the most important efforts were what are called the Oslo Peace Accords. So in 1993, for the first time, Israeli and Palestinian political leaders recognized each other, recognized the idea was that the Oslo Accords of 1993 were going to start a process that would lead to a two-state solution. The sticking point, the main sticking points at that time came down to what would the two states be in terms of land? What would the two states be in terms of of population? When, if I when I teach about this in a class in central Wisconsin, it looks pretty easy. You've got the 1948 borders of Israel, and since 1967, Israel has has retained control of the Gaza Strip and the West Bank as occupied territories. Effectively, the idea of of the Oslo Accords was that those regions would would be the would be a Palestinian state. Since 1967, Israel, Jewish Israelis have been settling in the West Bank and until 2005, even in Gaza, so that you've got a significant and politically powerful group of Israeli Jews living in lands that that are supposed to be the foundation of a future Palestinian state. So one question is basically what's going to happen with those settlements?
Right.
And from 1948 to the present, their descendants have lived as lived as refugees, where they were not allowed to return to their former homes that were now Israel after the war. They were not assimilated into the surrounding Arab states where they ended up. So in the field we refer to this as the right of return. That is to say, what will be the rights of these descendants of those 1948
So that's
refugees?
a key component in these discussions.
Absolutely. And keep in mind, again, Demir alluded to this. Over half the population of, if we focus on Gaza, over half the population of Gaza are Palestinian refugees. So this is
Significant.
of key importance for that population. For at least, well, for at least 9 years, there's been no effective dialogue, and one could really, push that back, almost 20 years.
Why is that there hasn't been a lot of discussion? And what's it going to take to restart that?
Oh, there's a lot of factors, but ultimately, what we're kind of getting at is it possible to have a two-state solution, right? That's how we discuss it. You'll see articles about that. That's how we maybe bring it up in class. And there's a lot of factors. One of it could be, well, what does the existing Israeli government think, right? Who's the prime minister? What is their relationship with the existing US president? They were better with Netanyahu and Trump. They were worse off when Netanyahu had to deal with Barack Obama. And although we've had this, as Biden calls this, unshakable support for Israel, the relations between the Biden administration and Netanyahu administration aren't as strong as they were with the Netanyahu and Trump administration. The other factor is, of course, the kind of spoiling effects that Hamas has been engaging with. So the U.S. will not negotiate with terrorist organizations. Hamas is classified as a terrorist organization. So any kind of peace process, peace plan will have to be one where Hamas is not in the picture. Well, Hamas is certainly in the picture right now. And they have been for a very long time. And Edgar was talking about some of these points already, but I'll kind of say that there's these four main issues, and they're big issues. They're not issues that we can kind of just check off. What should happen to Palestinian refugees? Should they have the right to return? We're talking millions of people. This would obviously disrupt or create new demographics, which would ultimately create a minority Jewish state, and I think the state of Israel probably wouldn't support that. Whether Jewish settlements are legal or not legal under international law. There's been debate over this. The UN and most international powers have agreed that these settlements are illegal, right? And the Israeli settlements in the West Bank or a couple in the Golan Heights and up until 2005 in the Gaza Strip. Here's a really big one we haven't really mentioned. There's this important city called Jerusalem, right? How do we share this site between these two people and a city that is a sacred place for Christians, Muslims, and Jews, and then whether and how the borders would actually look between a Palestinian state and Israeli state. This would be an existing Palestinian state if all of these other things could be worked out. If Hamas is not in the picture, right, and these two sides sit down to, something like a new version of the Oslo Accords, you still have an existing Palestinian state within an already existing Israeli state, right? It's not sort of this clean cut, right, where you get the north, we get the south. It wouldn't look like that. So a lot of issues still on the table, and they have been for a very long time.
Boy, I mean, do you see hope for the future, or I mean, is this war going to be going on for a long time? What do you think?
Well, Netanyahu has made the case that, and according to him, that it's kind of the beginning of the end of Hamas. So maybe that's the case. Others have are sort of skeptical over whether you can fully destroy or eliminate Hamas. And the question is, if you do, there's other groups like Palestinian Islamic Jihad. There's other groups in the region that could rise up. And so there has been a push internationally for a ceasefire over the humanitarian crisis. So we'll see if that kind of ramps up. I think a lot of that is still on the United States. As long as we're willing to support Israel and back Israel, that becomes a little bit more difficult. But if you have strong, legitimate Western support for a ceasefire, that might put a little bit more pressure on Israel, especially considering the humanitarian crisis in Gaza. So will this be a long war? I'm not quite sure. I wouldn't say it would be years long. Will the two-state solution be something that they pick up once fighting has stopped? I don't think so, right? I don't think we're there yet. And I don't think the Netanyahu government is willing to even consider these talks with the Palestinian Authority. So we're very much away from that idea. And we have been for a while now, as Edgar noted. Fighting could cease, but again, it would take immense international support, kind of continued immense international support.
We have about 2 minutes left in our time together, Edgar. I'd like your take on that. What's it going to take? How long is this war going to last? And are we going to eventually see a solution here?
I agree with most of what Demir said, and thank him for bringing up those. Bringing up these salient points, the war, the war itself, everything I hear from coming out of the Israeli Defense Ministry really is measuring the ground fighting in terms of months, probably. My question is slightly different. What then after? Not just the human destruction, but the destruction of the of infrastructure of of Gaza. So that's kind of one. And let's assume that Israel achieves its goal of removing Hamas. Who's going to govern Gaza? Israel has said that they don't want to govern Gaza. The leader of the Palestinian Authority has been quoted as saying that he will not ride into Gaza on an Israeli tank, that he has no interest in taking over Gaza under those circumstances. It's so what will happen to the infrastructure of Gaza? What will ha how will Gaza be ruled? We don't know, and I don't think that Israeli planners have thought that through. The one other major change I think to look for, again, this is months, maybe even years down the line. I'm going to be a fool and make predictions about Israel-Palestine.
Go ahead, go ahead.
And I see, I see the October 7th attacks and this war as something that may have long-term political repercussions, at the very least, for Netanyahu. Israelis have been outraged that that the Israeli security forces did not catch this attack before it
Right.
happened.
And there were signs. I mean, the intelligence reports were there. It's
And Israel has prided itself on its military and its
yes.
intelligence for years, and it looks like looks like they were caught with they were caught unawares, to
Yes.
use a less colorful phrase.
Yeah. I knew what you were going to say.
What that would mean then for Israeli politics and for the potential for a two-state solution is completely unclear. Would it lead to Israeli government, Israeli government and Israeli politics more willing to work towards some two-state solution, or would it lead to even more hardline governments or somebody else that looks like Netanyahu, but with a different name?
We'll have to wait and see. I want to thank you both for talking about this very serious subject with us today. Very fascinating. I thank you both. You're listening to Route 51. I'm Shireen Seward, once more extending a sincere thank you to our guests, Dr. Demir Kovacevic and Dr. Edgar Francis. Our producers are Joy Ratch-Kramer and Ezra Wall. Our executive producer is Ezra Wall, who is also our on-air producer today. Thanks to John Altenberg for the Route 51 theme. You can hear the archive of today's program, as well as our previous programs, at wpr.org/Route 51 and on your favorite podcast platform. Thanks for joining us. You're listening to Wisconsin Public Radio.